4. A Piece of the Sky, August 17, 1968. And now pick up this silver open-face watch, which the signalman carries always tucked into the narrow left inside breast pocket of the cheap suits he wears. It was the property of one of his 4 great-grandfathers before him, and he's carried it since the day she died. It is this watch that will earn him his nickname. His mother kept it in an old Whitman sampler tin on her dresser. Pick up this tarnished silver watch, manufactured in 1888 by the Elgin Watch Company of Elgin, Illinois, and wind the stem counterclockwise, turning the hands back 34,256 full revolutions. By this action do we arrive at the evening of August 17, 1968, and the living room of a house on the outskirts of Birmingham, Alabama. It's Saturday night, and NBC affiliate WVTM Channel 13 is airing its weekly late-night triple-feature monster movie marathon. The child, who will someday be known to his co-workers and a few others as the Signalman, is 8 years old, and he's allowed to stay up Friday nights into Saturday mornings to watch these black-and-white gems. While his parents sleep, the boy is treated to Ray Harryhausen's Redosaurus, Charles Laughton's Quasimodo, and finally English director James Whale's little-known and once-believed-lost The Star Maiden, 1934. As with his classic Frankenstein, Whale chose the palette of gothic horror for this science fiction fantasy tale set on an undiscovered trans-Neptunian 10th planet located beyond newly discovered Pluto, near the farthest edges of the solar system. The special effects come courtesy Willis O'Brien, fresh off King Kong and Son of Kong, with an unnerving, distinctly modernist score provided by Max Steiner, another Kong vet, and a screenplay by none other than Tarzan creator Edgar Rice Burroughs. The Star Maiden marks the only time that Burroughs would write for the screen. The boy sips at a Coca-Cola, the soda gone flat from half a handful of salted peanuts he dropped into the bottle, and he tries hard to stay awake. But it's a rare Friday night that he manages to make it through all 3 features. He's drifting off, and the movie is beginning to blur together with half-formed dreams. Tomorrow he'll have trouble remembering which bits of the story were actually part of the movie and which bits he made up in his sleep. A willowy woman with white hair is locked in a black tower in a city at the edge of a blacker plain. From her prison she gazes out through barred windows across the weird angles of a city carved from obsidian and onyx, granite and slate, across rooftops and strange hanging gardens, and past the spires of other towers. Overhead, the sun is only a faint smudge peering down at this world through a veil of perpetual night. The white-haired woman has been shut away by an evil ancient man, who might be an alchemist, or a scientist, or a wizard. This is never made quite clear, and who intends the woman to be his bride, very much against her will. Her only hope for deliverance is a sword that can defeat the dragon-like, stop-motion beast that guards the tower gates. But the sword was lost long ages ago in a dimly remembered war between the people of this world and giants who attempted to invade and conquer it from another dimension. There is a hero, of course, a handsome man with hair as pale as the woman's. He eludes the alchemist's robot soldiers and travels far from the city to reclaim the sword, which, it turns out, was stolen by a grotesque race of winged, crab-like humanoids, creatures who inhabit a forest of immense growing fungi, tall as redwoods, at the edge of an underground sea. They worship the very beings who were once defeated by the magical sword, hiding it in hopes that someday those extra-dimensional titans will return. The creatures speak in a language that sounds like the buzzing of bees. Back at the Black Tower, the villain wields an enormous spyglass and confides in his prisoner, revealing to her the recent discovery of a planet orbiting much nearer to the sun, a paradise of blues and greens, which he intends to conquer and enslave with a deadly heat ray. Then, he tells her, they will travel together through the ether to rule over this new domain as its rightful king and queen. Just how this trip will be accomplished is never fully explained, but the method of conveyance is clearly nothing so mundane as a rocket ship. Only our minds, says the alchemist, need leave this sphere and make the long, cold journey through the dark. These bodies we wear are no more, my love, than tattered garments we've outgrown. In the new world we'll have new forms, new bodies. Two surgeons are summoned, stooped men who look more like vultures, and the white-haired woman is sedated with a drop of some narcotic tincture. The surgeons then strap a bizarre metal cap over her head, preparing to cut open the skull and remove the brain. Meanwhile, our hero, who has managed against all odds to wrest the sword from the claws of the flying crustaceans, battles the dragon thing that guards the tower gates. The maiden, the mad scientist, the champion. Three crisply drawn archetypes. Think of them as tarot cards. Think of the film as a reading. According to the Los Angeles Times and various other newspapers and tabloids, the actress who played the heroine in The Star Maiden died a mere 5 weeks after production wrapped, having sustained massive brain injuries in an automobile accident. The irony hasn't been lost on the morbid sort of movie buff who catalogs so-called cursed films. While the fact of her death is well documented, there are rumors that she'd become paranoid and left behind a diary with a very peculiar final entry, several pages that rambled on about nightly visits by tall men in black suits who came to the windows and watched her when they thought she was sleeping. They spoke in buzzes and clicks, she's supposed to have written. The actor who played the alchemist, he died the next year of a morphine overdose, after his homosexual love affair with a much younger screenwriter became common knowledge among his peers. He appears to have had connections to a number of hermetical and theosophical societies, and to have corresponded during the last 3 years of his life with Aleister Crowley and other occultists. As for the hero of the tale, he left acting in 1936 and moved to New Mexico, where he wrote a pair of science fiction novels, Star Lost and Sunfall, neither of which was ever published, and both of which amounted to little more than barely coherent theories about life on Venus and Mars, a secret Martian base beneath the desert, and the role he believed aliens to have had in the emergence of communism and the October Revolution. He was found dead in 1946, long after the Star Maiden was all but forgotten, the last print believed to have been destroyed in a Burbank theater fire. And there was the cameraman who is said to have hanged himself during filming. And the makeup artist, who might have died a few hours after the premiere. And the strangers said by some, including the director, to have haunted the set. Men in dark suits who came off sounding an awful lot like the actress's peeping toms. Make of this what you will, or make of it nothing at all. 10 minutes from the end, the 8-year-old boy loses his struggle, slipping from half awake to fast asleep. It'll be 26 years and then some before he learns how it all played out, whether the maiden was rescued and the villain defeated. 26 years before he's known to those few who know him as the Signalman, and he's shown how the film, thinly disguised as fiction, a nightmare that unfolded on a remote Vermont farm in 1927. How it foreshadowed still other more ominous events in the decades after its release. One day it will lead him, however indirectly, to a rundown diner in Winslow, Arizona. The best foreshadowing never seems like foreshadowing.